BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi there, this is Claudia Hammond. Welcome to Inside Health, the Virus from BBC Radio 4, recorded on May the 26th, 2020. Hope you're okay. This is the last in this series, which means the last visit to Southampton General Hospital. Inside Health's Erica Wright has been to the car park every Monday to stand 2 metres away from different staff. And now they've got a whole new kind of hospital to plan, haven't they?
Yes, so like many others, they're feeling exhausted and really, you know, after this big adrenaline rush of dealing with the pandemic, they're now basically confronting the reality of having to coexist with a deadly virus.
Well, more from Erica later. And NHS workers are frequently described as heroes, putting their lives at risk while showing immense kindness to people who are very ill indeed. But there are some in healthcare who feel uncomfortable with the label. Before all that, it was March the 16th when people over the age of 70 or with certain medical conditions were told they would need to take extra measures to protect themselves from the virus for the next 12 weeks. There are more than 2 million people in this so-called shielding group. While the rules on lockdown are gradually being relaxed for others, they must continue to shield. So what's it like watching from inside while the world outside starts to get a bit busier? Tania lives in London with her husband and teenage daughter, and she knows that she cannot risk catching this virus. She's had rheumatoid arthritis since the age of 7 and knows she has a compromised immune system. She also has heart problems, and on top of all that, her arthritis has led to various operations in which her joints were fused, including her neck. And this means if she did become very ill and need to go on a ventilator, the process of putting a tube down her throat to attach to the ventilator or intubation is very difficult. So I asked her how she first dealt with the threat of a disease that she knew could do her so much harm.
Like most disabled people, planning is a really important part of how we function. And so we planned for 3 weeks worth of food deliveries, and I needed to make sure I had 3 months worth of all my medication. And then we made a room downstairs in the living room, put a bed in there, and worked on the basis that if it did come to it, I would be able to pretty much live in the dining room and sleep there.
And did you have to do that for a little while to keep separate from them in the home?
We did, because my daughter, when she was at school, we found out that quite a few people in the community were going down with coronavirus. So we took the decision that we were going to take her out of school. And so from that Monday onwards, for the 2 weeks from her coming back from school that day, we would make sure that we isolated or shielded within the family. And that was really quite difficult, because that was 2 to 4 metres away from them at any time. I couldn't hug my daughter. I couldn't get really close when I was helping with homework. And I had all my own cutlery and plates, and I ate separately from them. And it was particularly for my husband, who was having to make sure that every single surface was clean before I went into the kitchen and did anything. It was pretty hard work, but we knew that after the end of the 2 weeks, we'd then be able to isolate as a family.
So it's been 10 weeks now. How's it been for you all in the house?
Well, to begin with, it was pretty tough. We got very worried about food at one point when it was incredibly hard to get food deliveries and get onto lists. But I think the issue is going to be with schools and when my daughter goes back to school, because we really do want her to go back when it's safe for her to do so. But at the point that she does go back, we will need to move back into the shielding separately scenario. So that means I'll have to sleep separately from my husband again and move into the bizarre situation where I can't give my daughter a hug and get close to her when we're trying to do family things. And I think that's going to be really hard.
And of course, the whole idea of catching this virus is frightening for everybody. How has the risk of infection and the fear of it affected you?
I think in the first few weeks, I was really worried about it. But the worry of coronavirus has slightly lessened. It's more around the isolation and how long this needs to be going, and whether or not this is about coming to terms with the fact that we're going to have to live with it, that it's never going to go away.
So you're one of the people who's in the group who has underlying health problems. And that seems to be a phrase we hear ever such a lot now. How's it felt to be part of the group with that name, if you like?
It's been a bit of an odd one, really. The underlying health conditions or underlying health problems was bandied about and still is being bandied about in a way that I think is quite difficult. There's almost a sense where people were saying there have been X amount of deaths and there may be amongst people who've got underlying health problems. And it was almost as if it was trying to say, you don't need to worry because it isn't you. And I found that very divisive. And also the term that I don't like either is vulnerable, because I don't actually feel like a vulnerable person. I think that my situation is quite vulnerable and I think there are certain things that are making my life vulnerable. But a lot of those things are not about me. It's about the position that I'm in. But what I find more upsetting about it is that it doesn't seem to be too many steps away from other things that have been happening, like the do not resuscitate orders and those kind of discussions about who's valuable and who's not valuable. And almost that people who have got underlying health conditions and people who are so-called vulnerable should somehow expect to not be able to survive this. I know nobody said that explicitly, but that's the feeling.
So I wonder whether the aim was to reassure a lot of people by talking about things like the underlying health conditions, but then that also has the consequence of marginalising and worrying another group of people.
Well, that's exactly it. And that's why it felt incredibly divisive, that it was all about reassuring people by saying, it isn't you. And so there was this real sense of us and other that was developing around it. By the way, I do know that that sounds incredibly harsh, because I don't think that that was what was meant at all. I really don't think that that was an intention. It's just a reading of it that makes people feel anxious.
Yeah, so it could be an unforeseen consequence of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because what I do know is that the medical professionals have been absolutely stunning and have fought for every single life. And that's the thing that is incredibly reassuring. There's just so much amazing work that's happening out there. And the NHS in particular has been incredible in the way that it's been responding to need. And they aren't discriminating against people. It's just the feeling that you get around the messaging.
Thanks, Tania. Now, I remember doing my very first programme on a mystery virus in China back on January the 8th. Back then, we didn't even have a name for it, but soon the words coronavirus and COVID-19 became very familiar to all of us, along with a whole pandemic lexicon which has gone mainstream. Phrases which were once the preserve of scientists and researchers and programmes like this one are now commonplace.
The most important number, in my view, actually, over the epidemic as a whole, is going to be all-cause mortality.
The correct and final way of making these comparisons will be when we have all the excess death totals.
Herd immunity is not our policy. It's not our goal. Our goal is to protect life.
There is signs of the R going up again.
There was a significant peak in excess all-cause mortality in early April, and that has come right down.
Two people who know a lot about such language are Inside Health's Dr. Margaret McCartney and our regular guest, Professor Carl Hennigan, Director of the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine at the University of Oxford. So, Margaret, first, let me put this to you. All-cause mortality, we just heard how often that's used. What does it mean?
So all-cause mortality, it basically means all deaths. Everything is included in that. So it doesn't matter whether your death certificate says COVID-19 or pneumonia or something else, that death will be part of the all-cause mortality. And this is really important, because if we think that COVID-19 might be difficult to recognise in some sections of the population, and if we are not putting that down in death certificates, this is another way to try and find out whether the death rate in your population is higher than it would expect to be at that time of the year compared with previous years.
And there's a related phrase that's a bit different. And Carl, this is something you've been immersed in every week as you sieve and crunch the data around this. This is excess deaths. What does that phrase mean, and why is it so vital to this pandemic in particular?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting concept because what it means is we look at the number of deaths per week and we look at, are they more than what we'd expect for this week? So just today, the Office for National Statistics produces weekly updates. And today, there has been 14,537 deaths registered up to the weekend in the 15th of May. And that's 4,385 more than what we'd expect to see in this week. That's about 43% more. And that's quite a significant number. So if we look at it over this year, the first 20 weeks of this year, we'd normally expect to see about 225,000 deaths. And what we've seen actually is about 20% more, about an extra nearly 50,000 excess deaths in this period. Some of them are due to COVID, but some of them are due to the issues that Margaret said are other causes, which goes in this all-cause mortality number.
And Margaret, herd immunity is a phrase we used to only hear in the context of things like how vaccines like MMR were effective in the community. But how's it been used around this novel virus?
Okay, I have to confess, I hate the term herd immunity. I've used it myself, but I don't like the idea of herds because it reminds me of cows in a field. I prefer to talk about community immunity, the immunity that a community can hold against one threat or another. Now, the idea is that you have people within that community who are somehow weaker or who need more protection, and that protection is provided by the rest of the community. And there's two ways to get that community immunity. Either vaccinate the majority of your community, that would hopefully protect the people that can't be immunised for whatever reason, or everyone gets an infection and as a consequence of that, they develop immunity. And of course, you're hoping that by the vast majority of healthier people getting that infection, their immunity will protect the people who are unable to have that illness and survive it. But there's a really big problem with the concept of community immunity and COVID-19. And that is that we don't have a vaccine and we are not sure whether having had COVID-19 will give you a meaningful type of immunity that will protect you against a second bout of it in the same way that we would expect from other diseases such as measles or chickenpox.
And that will of course affect people's risk, and risk is another word that gets bandied about. But again, individual risk and risk at a population level are complicated to tease out. Carl, where does risk come into this?
Well, I think it's interesting. There's been lots of reports in the media where you just keep seeing numbers of deaths, and what's happening is people are starting to panic. And I think it's important to look at the number one factor here that increases risk is age. And actually, I've never seen such a risk factor where the difference between those young and those very elderly is so stark. So let me give you an example. If you take the age group 0 to 14-year-old, there's been 3 deaths. And that 3 deaths is in a population of over 10 million at that age group. So the risk of catching COVID and dying is about 1 in 3.5 million for those aged 0 to 14. And so I think that's hugely reassuring data. Your risk is that low. It's less than what it would be in terms of road traffic accident. So it's getting that risk in proportion. But where it does change is when you get to the very elderly. So if you take 90-year-olds, there's been about 7,500 deaths, but there's much less of them. There's only about 500,000 over 90-year-olds in the population. So their risk of death is 1 in 70 and much higher, and that's why they're disproportionately affected.
You've listened to a lot of people talking about and explaining the science and the health, and people try their best but inevitably might get the phrases wrong sometimes. Let me ask both of you, do you have any sort of pet hates or the phrases that make you cringe because they're not being said in the right way? Carl?
Well, one of the things that really perturbs me at times is the R number. There's a lot about talk to this. It gets up and we say the R number we think is somewhere between 0.7 and 1. The words think always make me clear about what's happening here is we are so uncertain, but we're going to make a best guess. Nobody can really understand the R number until we come after the effect. And it's a sort of averaging of what's going on and the problems with it. Nobody's quite clear how many people have been tested. Nobody's quite clear how many people actually have the disease at any one time. And so whenever you use or see that number, it is an educated guess. And it is wildly inaccurate at times because it doesn't take account of, for instance, what's happening in nursing homes, what's happening in hospitals, super spreading events. So I tend to downplay the R number. and go back to looking at the evidence and the facts.
Margaret, do you have any of these pet hates about particular words or phrases you hear being used wrongly?
The idea that was touted that upset me deeply was this idea that we would have immunity passports or wristbands or some type that you could flash to prove that you were immune. We do not have any evidence at all that that is the case. And can you imagine the impact of society if you're basically separating groups into immunity? I can see all sorts of fairly major social and ethical issues there.
Our resident GP, Dr. Margaret McCartney, with Professor Carl Hennigan. Now, during this whole series of Inside Health, the Virus, we've been following one hospital as they deal with the outbreak. So Erica Wright has been back to Southampton General Hospital for a final visit.
Yeah, it felt quite moving, actually, this week, because I think I said right at the start, I'm actually quite attached to this hospital. And for completion, I met Trevor Smith again. He's Divisional Director for Medicine and has responsibility for infectious diseases. And he actually kick-started my visit, so he was the first guy that I spoke to. And I was that close to sticking my hand out and following my instincts to shake his hand.
No,
I know, not allowed. And actually, it made me reflect that this hospital, bizarrely, it sounds weird, actually taught me to shake hands, because I mentioned at the start that both my parents worked there, and my parents had these big parties. They had a lot of students and junior doctors, and my dad was really popular but was terrible with names, so he used to stand me in front of him and I'd have to put my hand out really confidently and say, "Hi, my name's Erica," and they'd look back at me and say, "Hey, I'm Helen or John or whatever," and then my dad would then get the name and lean over and go, "Yeah," like he always knew who they were.
That's so clever. I need one of those.
Anyway, so the hospital's been busy with over 600 COVID positive admissions over the last 2 to 3 months. They've tested all hospital admissions, but as we've said more than once on this programme, you know, testing is not clear cut. So there's been a huge adrenaline rush to manage the pandemic, lots of reconfiguring of the hospital. But now there's a realisation and, you know, quite a lot of exhaustion as they face unlocking and the idea they're actually going to have to coexist with this virus. So that's where I started when I chatted to Trevor.
So the two big headlines of what the NHS provides are emergency care and cancer care. And in the new world of COVID, those two pathways of care do not sit neatly together, because we've got to ensure that the cancer care we deliver are absolutely the safest pathways they can possibly be. Whereas COVID, you know, we don't know what the challenges of COVID will be in the coming weeks. We have to prepare for the possibility of a second spike. We hope and pray that that doesn't happen. But if we were to see a surge in COVID admissions, then that is going to have an impact on our capacity to deliver cancer pathways. That's the broad, big challenge that we have, and I suspect every other NHS hospital has. The traffic that we've seen on the roads this morning are at the levels that we would see at any other bank holiday weekend. So the next 2-3 weeks, we're going to know.
Heading down to Bournemouth Beach.
Yep.
So now you have this really difficult situation of effectively having to live with COVID. How do you do that?
So meticulous attention to detail around how you run two hospitals, really, or perhaps three or four hospitals in that...
Well, all within one hospital.
All within one hospital. And people will present to the front door of our hospital or through an outpatient clinic with symptoms. And the first step on that pathway is to establish which patients do have COVID and which don't. And therefore, you separate those people out. You've heard one of my colleagues earlier on this series around the challenges around false negative tests, and those cases are small in number, but it gives you an indication that it's not simply doing a test and saying yes or no. There's a grey area, and I suppose in medicine we've always been used to looking after grey areas, but grey has become really important in what we do and how we manage the hospital.
One very big grey area right
now. One very big grey area. But I often hear people say, and I've said it myself, that it was much easier to switch things off than it is to switch things back on. That challenge is considerable.
And this is all about infection control. I wondered if there is a figure for the hospital-acquired infection so far.
Yeah, so we've had about 100 patients, we think, contract COVID whilst they've been in the hospital. Now, that is difficult to define accurately, so I think that that's the kind of worst-case scenario, if you like. But nevertheless, it's 100 more than we would want. And I've heard very similar figures for pretty much every other healthcare organisation.
I've heard, or I read in the British Medical Journal, a figure of 10 to 20% for hospital-acquired infection nationally.
I don't think we're as high as that in Southampton, but that certainly feels about right, just knowing how hospitals work and function. You know, we've got to make sure that our hospitals are the safest places they can possibly be. because whilst the prevalence of COVID out in the community is now very much at the lowest level, by the nature of the fact that we see sick people in hospital, hospitals will become hotspots. We cannot have 10 to 20% of the hospital population getting COVID in a hospital. That is not acceptable. Otherwise, we are going to see unnecessary harm and unnecessary deaths.
And I believe NHS England have said going forward that people coming in for planned surgery should have a two-week isolation period before.
Yes. So essentially every patient that comes to the hospital for a planned admission will be tested, and that will be 48 hours before their admission. But where possible, and I think this will be possible for the vast majority of people, it will be self-isolation for 14 days. And so if you're coming in for a major cancer operation, I think most people will take a view that that's an achievable and the right thing to do. If you're coming in for perhaps a routine diagnostic procedure, which we've done for years, to suggest to people that they need to self-isolate for 14 days, whilst clinically, medically is the right thing to do, is a big ask for people.
Is there a sense, though, that hospitals as we know them, the infrastructure just isn't designed to deal with an aerosolised virus like COVID-19? Chris Hill, who I spoke to at your A&E department, said that all the ventilation systems had to be switched off and they were sweating away in their PPE.
This has challenged the NHS and hospitals in a way that we've never seen before, and I think that the NHS will never be the same again. And, you know, our systems were never designed to do this. You know, we're sat out here now in front of our emergency department with ambulances pulling up. We do have a lockdown COVID unit, but that has come at the expense of great challenge to other services. You know, we don't have an estate which we can simply just hive off to look after COVID.
And what about the morale of staff? As you say, that was almost easier to lock down. How are they feeling now that they're facing this for quite a long time?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we spoke a few weeks ago, I talked about fear, and that fear has passed. I think there are maybe three emotions. One is exhaustion. The second is grief that the world that we knew has gone. And maybe the third emotion is optimism, actually. I think that the NHS will always respond positively. I think our greatest strength are the people that work within it.
And did the Banksy picture help?
It did, curiously, and it's amazing.
Oh, I'm glad he liked the Banksy. So this was something donated a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
That's right. And I haven't actually seen it in the flesh because obviously not allowed to go into the hospital. But it is the most amazing artwork done by Banksy. It's all black and white, apart from there's one red cross on a nurse's uniform. And you see this child kneeling down, dungarees, sort of very kind of 50s, all black and white. And he's playing with, and first of all, you think it's an aeroplane or a superhero. And then you see that actually it's a nurse doll with a beautiful red cross on it, a bit like Call the Midwife kind of uniform.
It's just like the nurse Cindy that I used to have,
yes. Now she's owning up. And and so you see this, and then you notice that actually in the bin next to the kid are Batman and Spider-Man, two heroes who've basically been discarded and displaced by the nurse who is the superhero. And it ties in with all the clapping that we've heard on Thursday, this idea that the healthcare workers are somehow involved, vulnerable, that there are saviours. And not everybody adheres to this concept. So we saw a tweet by somebody called Michael Fitzpatrick recently and picked it up, and he'd written this amazing counter-argument to why we might think differently. So we thought it'd be really lovely end to the programme to record it. He's a gastroenterologist in Oxford and is the co-chair of the Royal College of Physicians Trainees Committee. And here it is.
I want to talk about heroes.
Doctors and nurses are not heroes. Calling them heroes, or saviours, or angels is well-meaning, but unhelpful. I also worry that this narrative is being co-opted deliberately by some who seek to undermine the professionalism of the medical workforce and to silence their voice. A hero is defined as a person who is admired or idealised for courage, outstanding achievements, or noble qualities. In the ancient myths, heroes were nigh on invincible. Those same themes live on in war movies, in comics, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Many of these heroes are unpaid, rich volunteers. Thor is a king and a god. Tony Stark has more money than he knows what to do with. Batman is a rich recluse.
What are your superpowers again? I'm rich.
They don't work to pay the bills or feed their kids. They are also semi-invulnerable. Bruce Wayne has his fancy armour, Iron Man his suit, Captain America his vibranium shield. There are no PPE concerns here. These guys bring their own to the party.
Jarvis, you there?
At your service, sir.
And when they die, they do so, well, heroically. It was their job, their lot, to die in battle. And how do we reward heroes? Not with cash, that's for sure. We clap, we cheer, we hold parades. We place them on a pedestal, one that does not allow them to come down to our human level. They don't need appropriate working conditions, work-life balance, lunch breaks, or a mug of tea. And if a hero is struggling psychologically, what do they do? How does Iron Man deal with his post-traumatic stress and flashbacks following the Battle of New York? How does Thor deal with his food binges and problematic drinking after Infinity War? By more work, of course. More fighting. Bring me Mjolnir.
I'm still worthy.
So as we can see, heroes are almost entirely the wrong comparator for healthcare workers. But does this matter? Aren't the public and the newspapers and the media just being kind and supportive? Am I just being a bit grumpy? I worry there is a darker side to this, because there's another thing about heroes. They are only ever loved in the crisis. Batman goes back into hiding. Thor returns to Asgard. The heroes hide. They slink away. They're a threat now. No one wants to hear their thoughts on social inequalities or healthcare funding models. The hero metaphor is therefore a useful tool for those who don't want to hear from healthcare professionals afterwards. Don't talk about PPE. Don't talk about student debt. Don't talk about public health or working conditions. Don't talk about healthcare funding. Go back to the shadows. Now, this is very different if we change that narrative to one that centres around professionalism. Because their views matter, both during the crisis, but importantly afterwards. They don't need medals. They need PPE and equipment and training. They don't work for claps. They work for remuneration commensurate with their expertise. So that's why I don't think my colleagues are heroes. They are more than heroes. More real, more important, more valuable. They are highly trained, dedicated, caring professionals. Thank you to all my colleagues who are working so hard in this epidemic. My heart goes out to the families of those professionals who have died, both here and abroad. Thank you for your work. Thank you for your service. And I hope a grateful society will listen to you after this.
Michael Fitzpatrick. And that is the end of this series of Inside Health, the Virus. Thanks to the producers Fiona Hill and Erica Wright, and to the studio manager today, Jackie Mardrum. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Claudia Hammond. This is the last in this series, but Inside Health will be back in the summer. And from next week, I'll be here with a new series of the podcast, All in the Mind.